Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in San Jose, California, and was a Marine pilot who flew 120 combat missions in World War II and the Korean War. He played for the New York Yankees for 9 seasons and has been a baseball announcer for 48 years. Since 1972, he's been the lead radio announcer for the San Diego Padres. Some of his key phrases are, "Oh, doctor, you can hang a star on that baby," "The natives are getting restless," and "The beat goes on." His name, Jerry Coleman. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome. We're with Jerry Coleman, who's been the lead radio announcer for the San Diego Padres since 1972. Jerry, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Jack, it's nice to be here. Nice to talk to you as well.
Can we start by talking about your parents and what they taught you growing up in San Jose, California?
Well, actually, I've got to correct that. I was born in San Jose because my mother was raised in San Jose, and we were living in San Francisco, or at least my parents were. She went down to San Jose because of the physician that she grew up with, had the birth, and came back to San Francisco a few days later. So basically, I was born in San Jose, but totally raised in San Francisco.
What did they teach you, Jerry?
Well, I think anything that happens, you know, my father was a semi-pro baseball player, and I loved baseball. I enjoyed that very much. My mother was an angel. She was one of those people that took care of the family. And my mother and father split in the middle of the Depression. I don't know what happened there. I never got around to asking. But later, things got so difficult for my mother and my sister and I that she remarried my father, and then we went from there about 1936 onward.
What sports did you play as a kid in school?
Well, actually, there were no sports. I played CYO baseball, I guess about 10 or 11, and then in junior high is when I really got into the sports scene. Most of the activity I had as a youngster was at the playground. You know, we'd get a tennis ball and had broomsticks and so forth and use that kind of weapon as a bat. But more importantly, the real sports with me began at junior high school in San Francisco, and it was track mostly. I loved track. I could run pretty well. In fact, at CYO, I won the track meet for my weight in 1936, I guess it was. What was I, 10 or 11 years old then, 12, I suppose. And then from there, I got into basketball in my ninth grade in junior high. Then when I got to high school, when I really began to get an interest in sports, in basketball and baseball.
Joe DiMaggio grew up in San Francisco, if I believe. Did you ever play against him as a kid?
As a kid? He's 10 years older than me. I played with him with the Yankees.
Yes.
In 1948, 50, 51. But, no, when Joe was playing for the Yankees, I was, I was in high school. And but his, you know, in 1941, when he set the record for consecutive games in hitting at 56, every day it was a headline story. It was incredible.
You joined the Marines in October of 42. You're 17 years old. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, that was a naval aviation program. In 1942, in March of 1942, I was 17 at the time. And they brought all the senior high school students into the auditorium, boys only. And from the back of the room walked in two naval aviators and whose wings were at least 4 feet wide. And I thought, oh, boy, that's for me. Because we were all thinking about what branch of the service we were going to go into. And basically, at that time, Joe Foss and was a great air hero in the Solomon Islands. And so, consequently, he became a sort of a magnetic force for us. And when I became 18, which was September of 1942, I joined up. It took about 3 weeks to get through the process. And finally, I was programmed in October and went into the service in October of 1942. And then I was a naval aviation cadet. it took about a year and a half, a little longer, to get your wings. And when I finally was given my wings, I decided to join the Marine Corps as a naval aviator.
You flew 57 combat missions in World War II. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, people are shooting at you. It's not much fun, I must tell you. Of course, you're scared. You're young. In fact, I always tell a story. I was in dive bombers. I chose dive bombers because in June of 1942, the SBD dive bomber sunk the four carriers in the Pacific, and I wanted to sink a carrier. So I joined the dive bombers and ended up in the Marines as a dive bomber. But I tell a story that I was 19, rather. My gunner was 18. And I always say, if the Japanese knew what they were up against, they would never have surrendered because we were so young and inexperienced. But it was just one of those things. We were the first. I joined a squadron called BMSB. That's heavier than air Marine scout bombers, but they're dive bombers. And we were the first squadron organized in close air support for the Marines. And we went into the Solomon Islands, and then from there to the Philippines. And actually, the best thing that ever happened to me, I was overseas about a year, and they called all senior, not in rank, I was a second lieutenant, they called all senior pilots overseas who were carrier qualified back to the States. This was in, late July, early August. And when we got back, they sent us home for a week and leave, and it was then that the war ended. And I can't imagine what would have happened had the war not ended. We would have gone to Japan. Who knows what kind of casualties we would have had. It would have been incredibly bad, I'm sure.
Tom Brokaw's The Greatest Generation. You're a member of that.
Well, you know, I must tell a story about that, because The Greatest Generation, obviously, on December the 7th, 1941, the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor, and the entire country came together. But don't forget, September the 9/11,
yes.
2001?
Yes.
The same thing happened. This country always comes together. The Greatest Generation is now and will always be right now.
We're talking to Jerry Coleman. Ernie Harwell says this about Jerry Coleman. All of us talk or write about sports overuse the word hero. But when the San Diego Padres play the Tigers, a genuine hero is with them. He's Jerry Coleman, the radio voice of the Padres. Jerry's my hero because he twice interrupted his baseball career to serve his country as a U.S. Marine pilot. One of the greatest pleasures of my career was to share a microphone with Jerry on the CBS Game of the Week, a true gentleman, a top-notch Yankee star, an ex-major leaguer, and an outstanding Hall of Fame announcer, Jerry Coleman.
Well, Ernie's one of my better friends and one of the people that I look up to as far as broadcasting is concerned. Don't forget, Ernie was in the war, too, and he did his share as well. But there are no real heroes. All you're really doing is your job, period. That's the way we looked at it. We did our job, and actually fighting in the air is cleaner than fighting on the ground. There's no mud, blood, and that sort of thing. If you went into a mission and you went into a dive, you'd pull up, and maybe Bill was missing. Where'd he go? Nobody saw him. Oftentimes, they just disappeared. But on the ground, you looked at people's arms being blown off and people dying in front of you. We didn't have that tragedy in front of us.
We're talking to Jerry Coleman. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're with Jerry Coleman, who played for the New York Yankees for 9 seasons, from 49 to 57. Jerry, you came up with the Yankees in 49. Can you talk to us about that experience?
Well, it was really exciting, I must tell you. Actually, I came up in September of 48, very briefly. I didn't play in any games, but it was that time that the Yankees and Cleveland and Boston were in a dead battle for the first place in the American League. And I think at that point, Cleveland won out and went on to the World Series. But basically, I sat on the bench for about a month, scared to death they put me in because, Bucky Harris was the manager. I'd never been in the big leagues or in a pennant race. And it wasn't until the following year where Casey Stengel took over, who liked young players and gave me a chance to play. And the funny thing was, I didn't even know I was going to make the ball club, because in 1948, I had a so-so year at Newark. I didn't have a big season. And one day, a guy by the name of Joe Trimble, was a writer for the Daily News, came out and said, here, sign this ball. And it had all the names of some of the top players on the cover. I said, what's this for? He said, well, you made the team. I didn't even know it. And that's how I found out I made the ball club. And fortunately for me, but unfortunately for George Sternweiss, who was a second baseman at the time, and I had played almost no second base at all. I'd been a shortstop and third baseman. He got hurt, and they gave me a chance to play, and I got off to a good start and then finally got the job. But it was kind of scary. You know, when you're at Yankee Stadium with 65,000 to 70,000 people, it's a lot of people up there, and you're very much aware of what's going on. And it's kind of frightening in a way.
In 1950, you get to the World Series. You sweep the Philadelphia Phillies, the Whiz Kids, and you're named the MVP of that World Series.
Well, it wasn't that it was that dramatic. What happened was every time I came up, there was a run to be scored. And, you know, I think we won 1-0, 2-1, 3-2, and finally 5-2. But there were very few runs scored in that series. And it seemed as though every time I came up, something was happening. And it gave me an opportunity to perform a little bit more than I would normally. So, yes, I did get the MVP award. I'm very proud of that. But basically, that was my last real year, because in 1951, I had a so-so season. But in 52-3, I was gone. 54, I had eye problems. I didn't realize till the season was halfway through. 55, I broke my collarbone. I was out 3.5 months. The night I came back, I got beaned. I was out another 2 weeks. So I really missed about 4 years. And finally, in 56 and 7, I got a little bit better, but then time was running out, and I was now 32.
Speaking of missing a couple years, that was because you went back to the Marines for the Korean War.
Yeah.
You flew 63 combat missions. Was it tougher to go back after you had the baseball major league experience?
Well, it was tougher because I was older. I was 28 and 29, I think, and I had two children and a wife. And, you know, you're more conscious of your... I guess you're living and dying, because in World War II, I was invincible. I was 18, 19, 20, 21, you know, nothing can go wrong. But when you're older with a family, you think a little bit more about dying. Yes, you do think more about it completely.
In your 9 years, you played in 6 World Series. You won 4 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Few major leaguers have ever been in more than 1 or 2 World Series.
Well, in those days, you know, from 1949 to 53, the Yankees won every World Series. And one of the interesting things about those 5 years, I missed most of 52. And I played in only 18 games of 52 and maybe a half a dozen in 53. But in those 5 years, you know, people want to have good years. But in those 5 years, no Yankee player led the league in anything, in wins, losses, home runs, batting average. It was a total team effort, and that's, I think, one thing that has been lost in many cases today. Having a good year is more important than winning. In those days, you had to win to get your bonuses. In fact, I made more money in the World Series in 1949 than I did in salary, and consequently, winning was everything. So consequently, whatever it was, no matter what you did or how you did it, you had to win to get ahead.
You've observed these Atlanta Braves for the last 15 years. The job that Cheerholz has done, Bobby Cox has done, is unbelievable.
Brilliant. Yeah. So, well, Bobby's a good friend of mine. Now, he was a Yankee infielder when I was broadcasting games there, and I've known Bobby, good Lord, 40 years and more, and was truly a great manager. And John Cheerholz, really, he had Kansas City before that. They went to Kansas City, then he went to Atlanta. They kept winning and winning. This man is headed for the Hall of Fame, in my opinion. I think he's probably the best general manager ever put together on this earth.
If we could throw out a few names, Casey Stengel.
My manager?
Yes.
Well, he was my only big league manager except for a month when I was up there with Bucky Harris in 1948. And I was with Casey for 9 years. And I'll tell you, you know, people don't realize I remember, I think there was a headline in the New York paper then they said, Yanks hire clown. Well, Casey was a character, but he's one of the most brilliant baseball men I've ever known. He understood his players. He understood the front office, what they wanted. He understood the opposition. He understood everything about the game and how to win. He was really marvelous. And he's the only manager I've ever heard walk into the clubhouse and say, well, I blew it. That's mine. I blew it. He admitted that he had done something wrong. I didn't know what he did wrong, but he admitted that I did something wrong that cost us the ball game. But he was truly an energetic, incredible human being as far as baseball is concerned.
Your catcher was Yogi Berra.
Well, Lawrence Peter Berra wasn't much of a catcher in 1949. That's why they brought Bill Dickey in. And Dickey made a great catcher out of it. But, of course, Yogi could do one thing not many people could do. He could hit. And he might have been the most unpredictable hitter in the history of the game, like Ducky Medwick. There was no strike zone for him. He could hit anything, any place. And he was a wonderful person, just a great person. I saw Yogi about a month ago at the old-timers game. He's still the same, hasn't changed. Saw him at Cooperstown the other day. He's just great.
Were you ever privy to a conversation between Casey and Yogi?
I don't know that there was ever a conversation between Casey and anybody. Casey did all the talking. You know, if you ask Casey how things going, he'd talk for 20 minutes. Consequently, he didn't get to say much. But what he said was pretty much trying to alleviate whatever problem may be around. He was really brilliant at that. He just understood you more than you knew yourself. He was incredible.
We're talking to Jerry Coleman. When we come back, we'll ask him about a few more of the legends in the 50s and 60s. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Jerry Coleman, the only major leaguer to see combat in two major wars. Jerry, Mickey Mantle.
Well, you know, Mickey was my roommate for a couple of years. When I get back from Korea, I don't know what happened, but George Weiss called me and said, we'd like you to room with Mickey. And I was, I guess, 8, 9 years older than Mickey, whatever it was. They wanted an older man to sort of slow him down. Well, you know, Mickey was a guy, he was a follower, not a leader. And consequently, if somebody said, hey, let's go out and do this and that, he said, okay, let's go do this and that. You know, he was very, very easy to get along with. I found him delightful. In fact, we used to share rides in spring training. One day I would drive, the next day he would drive. And we'd pick up about 9 o'clock, I think it was. And one day I looked out the window, and there he was sitting in the car. And I said, why don't you honk the horn? He said, I didn't want to bother you. And in other cases, in those days, you know, the luggage was always picked up and packed by the players themselves up to the rooms. And if my luggage was down in the lobby, he brought it up for me. And I did the same for him. But he was really a delightful person. And unfortunately, it didn't end well for him. But when he said, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of him myself, he wasn't kidding. Because he had osteomyelitis, a form of cancer, when he was young. His father died in his early 40s. 2 uncles died in the early 40s. And he thought he was going to die. I was a player representative at that time. And I said, Mickey, this is what we're doing. He said, I'll never get anywhere. I won't live long enough. Well, he did live longer than he thought. But basically, I think it was sort of a death wish for him that to get as much in as he could. But I found Mickey Mantle to be a spectacular person. A human being, very shy, quiet, and yet he did drink a little too much, there's no question about that, but basically, he was a decent human being.
Who was the best ball player you ever saw, Jerry?
Well, I think DiMaggio would be that because, you know, if you look at DiMaggio's first 6 years, nobody in the history of the game did better. Just check him out. Find those first 6 years, go back to Ruth, to Gehrig, to, I guess, Albert Pujols now, these great players are all great, Williams and so forth. But nobody did any better than DiMaggio. But what happened in the 7th or 8th years, he went into the service, and he was never quite good enough after that. He was never the same player. But his first 6 years, he was incredible. He could run, he could throw, he could field. He had, you know, he struck out 13 times 1 year. Some guys do that in a week now. He's incredible.
I believe.
You know, always made contact, and he was a great leader, quiet leader, never made any speeches, but you knew what he wanted, and he knew how to lead you. He was incredibly great.
I believe in his career he had more home runs than he had strikeouts.
That's possible. You know, some guys strike out 150 times a year, in 2 years, 300. He struck out a little over 300 times in 13 years.
Yes.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I don't think he ever struck out over 40 times. I'd have to look it up. But for him to strike out 40 times in a year was very unusual. He was just a brilliant player, never made a mistake. And when you think of what Yankee Stadium was in those days, it was 461 feet to center, 457 left center, 440 right center. It was a huge expansive area out there. And that's where Mantle and DiMaggio got so much credit because they could run so well and had great judgment of a fly ball. I think overall he might have been the greatest player that ever lived. The other one would be Willie Mays. You put them together, two great, great players.
We're talking to Jerry Coleman. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Jerry Coleman, who's announced baseball games for 48 years. Jerry, how did you ever get into broadcasting games?
Accidentally, Jack, accidentally. I was, Bill McPhail was the director of broadcasting at CBS. In those days, he directed both radio and television. And CBS was coming up with a game of the week on television, and he asked me, would you like to be a broadcaster? And I'd never thought about it, Frank. In fact, the last thing on earth that I thought about. And I said, Bill, I just got a job with the Yankees as a personnel director. I can't quit that job and go be a broadcaster. I just signed on. So 2 years later, when I was on the road one year, 1959, I was on the road for 223 days up to October the 24th. I realized it was destroying my life and my family and everybody else. So I went to Bill and I said, is that job still open? He said, sure. So that next season, I went from the New York Yankee front office to broadcasting CBS, and I worked with Dizzy Dean and Pee Wee Reese. And my job was to do the pregame shows and whatever they wanted me to do. So that went on the Saturdays and Sundays until 1963 when the Yankees offered me a job as a play-by-play. But that was my first start. It was just sort of accidental. I had no intention whatsoever of being a broadcaster, nor did I want to be one. It just happened to me. I was very lucky.
You debuted handling pregame interviews for Dizzy Dean and Pee Wee Reese.
That's right, yeah. Well, there are only 30 million people watching, and I'm scared to death, of course. I'd never been on the air. And so I got a hold of Red Chandies I think it was the Milwaukee might have been playing, because Red was at that time with Milwaukee, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not totally sure. But I got him as an interview, and I said some great probing questions. Like, well, how's it going, Red? And he talked for 5 minutes, and I kissed him right on the spot, because I didn't know what to do. In fact, it was a few weeks later, I was in Chicago doing Cookie Lavaggetto, and they started to play the national anthem. Well, I didn't know what to do. No one ever told me what to do, in fact. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, they'll just cut and go to the flag. They didn't do it. They stayed on me, and I talked all through the national anthem in this interview, the worst thing ever. Now if I hear the national anthem in mid-stride, I stop. I don't care where I am. But then I didn't know. It took a while to find out. You know, when they put you on the air in those situations with you know, millions of people watching, you got to train you properly. Nobody ever trained me. It just accidentally happened.
The second show I ever did on this radio station, I interviewed Ernie Harwell. And as he was answering questions, Jerry, I'm in awe of the man. I'm in awe of the man.
Sure.
It was an unbelievable experience. So.
I know. Well, that's what happens when you're like that. You know, you're new, you don't know, and no one ever trains you. I would never do that again. Same thing when I managed. Good Lord, they brought me off the broadcast booth to manage. That should never happen. It's the wrong way to do it.
In 1963, you joined the Yankees radio team with a guy named Mel Allen, Red Barber, Joe Garagiola, and Phil Rizzuto.
Yep.
Unbelievable.
Well, that was incredibly unfortunate because that spring, in spring training, they put me on the air to do the first inning. And I'm thinking, oh, boy, three ground balls to the shortstop. Get out of here quick. And unfortunately, in that first half inning, 12 men went to the plate. Everything that ever happened in baseball happened in that half inning. I couldn't keep score. I didn't know what to do. And, you know, you talk about being thrown to the lines. You know, in both cases, with the CBS and with the Yankees, they got to train people. You should never, ever have that happen to you. But anyway, I finally survived, and here I am.
What's the greatest game you've ever announced?
That's a tough one. I guess the... you know, that's hard. I think possibly when I was with the Padres, when we won the National League flag in San Diego, probably was the most exciting game. Not the greatest, but the most exciting game, because in San Diego we never won. In fact, one of the reasons I became a manager out there, we lost 100 games every year, you know. And in 1984, we finally won the pennant after 12 years, and it was euphoric. I mean, I was beside myself. It was just wonderful.
You beat my Cubs in that game,
I believe. I remember, and I'm trying to think. Something went through the first baseman's glove.
Bull Durham. Oh, yeah. Leon Bull Durham, remember?
I forgot the name. I remember the circumstance, but I forgot the name.
How was it you ever got with the Padres to be their voice in 72?
I was living in New York for about 18 or 20 years, and my wife, who I loved dearly, hated the East Coast. So I saw Buzzy Babazy in 1968, who was then going to be part of the San Diego Padre operation. I said, Buzzy, I got to get to the West Coast. You got to hire me as one of your broadcasters. So he said, sure. So I hired three other guys. He hired Frank Sims, Jerry Gross, and Duke Snyder. I said, nuts. So I went to the West Coast anyway and finally worked my way into a job in Los Angeles, along with Tom Harmon, and I shared the broadcast at KTLA for a couple of years. And finally, in 1971, as I told you, I was a representative on the players' pension for many years, and they asked me to go to Chicago and talk to the owners about some players who were left out of the pension plan, which I did. And while I was there, I saw Buzzy. And he said, hey, I want to talk to you. I said, I could talk to you, too. So we made a deal in 1971, but I didn't go to work broadcasting until 72.
You're famous for sayings. Oh, doctor, you can hang a star on that baby. The beat goes on. The natives are getting restless.
Well,
how'd you come up with those things?
It's hang a star and old doctor. The old doctor came from Casey Stengel. Casey used to say, you got what I mean? You got what I mean, doctor? You know what I mean, doctor? You know what I mean? He kept saying that over and over. And so I used that as sort of a phrase. The strange part about that particular saying was, the year that the Padres won their first title in 84, I was listening to a replay of John Friedo's catch on DiMaggio long drive in left center field at Yankee Stadium, and Red Barber said, oh, doctor. And I said, oh, my God, nothing's original, because I'd worked with Red several years and never heard him say that. Anyway, now the hang a star is another one. If you went to school, every Friday you had a spelling test. It had 20 words, and on Friday, you had to get them all right. And if you got all 20 words right, you got a gold star. I consider that the epitome of excellence, because I never got a gold star. So that's where that came from.
I try to write 5 handwritten letters a day, Jerry, and I always put a gold star after their name.
I'll be darned.
And I've done this for 30 years.
I'll be darned.
And it is amazing when a person gets a gold star. They can be the president of General Motors.
Yeah.
They're like little kids.
Jack, that's my total approach. A gold star is the epitome of excellence.
I've never gotten one myself, Jerry.
Okay.
You're the master of the malaprop.
Mm-hmm.
You're legendary for Johnny Grubb slides into second with a stand-up double. Davis fouls out to third in fair territory. On George Hendrick, that's George Hendrick's 19th home run. One more, and he reaches double figures. How do you come up with these things?
Well, I talk fast and I make mistakes, and you know, I've got a couple that like a sliding into second base with a stand-up double. Actually, he slid into second base, but it was a pop-up slide. He was standing up when it was over,
okay.
And I just followed with the slide, you know. And of course, this is somewhat of a cop-out, but it's true. He slid into second base, standing up with a double. Anyway, the other one I had, we had a pitcher who was, so-so, and he was, they said that I said he's throwing up in the bullpen. Well, there's a phrase in baseball called throwing them up, you know, playing catch. And so they made that into throwing up in the bullpen. Well, he might have been if he had his stuff, you'd throw up anyway. But that's where that came from. The other ones I don't pay much attention to. I talk fast and make mistakes. It's not a big deal.
Who's the greatest baseball announcer you ever heard?
Well, I guess that Vin Scully gets credit for that. But, you know, if you saw Mel Allen in the early days when he was totally the guy, his presence, his effectiveness on the air was incredible. Today it's Vin Scully, I guess, would be the guy I'd go to first.
We're talking to Jerry Coleman. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Jerry Coleman, who was inducted into the broadcasting wing of the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 2005. Jerry, our own legendary Ernie Harwell. He's loved throughout this state. You did games with him. Can you share a couple of Ernie Harwell episodes?
Well, he was just a nice guy. He wore that crazy hat all the time, you know.
And still does.
I love the port. He was just a pleasant human being. He was a great, great broadcaster and dominated Detroit for years. I don't know. They got rid of him for a while. They got some lunatic in there that decided he wasn't worthy and then had to bring him back because they missed him so much. But, you know, what can I say about a person like that who's been a broadcast? Started in Baltimore, as I recall, I think. Did he go to Brooklyn eventually
yes,
and then on
yes.
to Detroit?
Yes, yes.
He was all over the place, but he basically settled in Detroit, found a home, and became the man in the Tiger City. He was incredible. Just, I don't know what more to say than that. He was a wonderful human being and pleasant to everybody. You know, when you were a kid, or like I was as a broadcaster, he treated you just like he'd been around for 100 years. He was a wonderful human being.
Everybody meets him, says the same thing.
Yeah. Well, that's the way he is. That's Ernie Harwell, period.
What
Not
does
to
it...
mention he was a great broadcaster on top of it.
What does it take to be a great broadcaster?
Be yourself. If it doesn't work, get another line of business. A lot of people try to copy. You know, there are a lot of people who try to copy Scully. You can't copy Scully. He's what he is. Be yourself. And don't try to be anything but yourself, because that's the only thing that's going to carry you. If you try to be somebody else, you'll never make it. Just be what you are. If that works, then you're okay. If it doesn't work, get another line of jobs.
What has baseball taught you about life, Jerry Coleman?
Well, it's been my life. You know, I started in 1942. What's that, 65 years ago? And I think that what it taught me most is teamwork. I think that is the most. People ask me, what would you like to be remembered as? I said, as a good team player, because teams win, individuals don't. In fact, one of the greatest players of all, A-Rod, went down to Texas. He was a great player. They came in last. They didn't have a good team. Teams win, individuals don't, especially in baseball. Unlike basketball, where maybe a dominant center can dictate what's going on. But in baseball, you better have a good team. If you don't have that, you don't win.
In 2005, you get inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. You go to Cooperstown. Can you share that experience with us?
Well, that's a desperate situation. You know, you're busy as sin. You're going night and day. You're doing this, doing that, and so forth. And it's kind of like you close your eyes and open it up, and you think it's going to be over, and you hope it does, because it's chaotic and hectic, but beautiful. There's no question. I was very surprised, very much surprised when that happened to me. I just never thought about it. It was not something I aspired to, but when they told me that I'd been elected, I thought, gee, that's pretty darn good. So I let it go with that.
Recently, about a month ago, you went back, or a few weeks ago, you went back. And this time, Tony Gwynn got in. Was it different this time?
Well, it was. It was more restful for me. I was a spectator then. But the thing that made that such a... That was the largest crowd in the history of Cooperstown, because you had two guys. You had Tony Gwynn, who had 8 batting titles. Only Hannes Wagner had that. And then you had the shortstop out of Baltimore, you know, that set the record for 2,600 consecutive games. Those are feats that are unparalleled, unmatched. And I don't think anybody, unless you go back to the initial group, had that kind of a crowd ever. It was unbelievable. It's just a remarkable moment for baseball, and I think a magical moment for the two men involved. In fact, Tony Gwynn is here in St. Louis with us broadcasting. What a great guy. You know, here's a guy, along with Hannes Wagner, maybe the greatest hitter that ever lived. I think hitting now is harder than it was when Williams played, because of the way they handle pitchers. And Tony had a .338 lifetime batting average, and nobody's close to that.
You were the voice of UCLA basketball for a year.
Yeah, I know. That was when John Wooden kept winning every year after year after year. I played basketball in high school, and I really was sort of out of sync in that thing, because that wasn't my strength. And I enjoyed it, but it was something that was a pleasure to watch Wooden, the way he handled his team.
What made him so good, Jerry?
Teamwork, period. Nobody was better than the other guy. And again, you go back to what's the most important thing in sports? Teamwork. You give yourself for the whole. And if you don't do that, then you run into trouble.
Are you hopeful about the future of America?
Well, I've never not been hopeful. I think that the 9/11 was a classic example. You know, this was 60 years, I guess, after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. This country came together, and it'll do the same if threatened. Tragically, there are problems over in the Middle East, and hopefully someday that'll get started and done. But one of the things I think people don't realize is that no one likes the Iraq War. But there's going to be a world war right now with certain groups that are after us. They want to get us. They want to get the Israelis. They want to knock us out of the box. You better protect yourself, because sooner or later they're going to be there, and you got to be wary and watch for them.
You talk over and over and over about team, team, team. To Jerry Coleman, what does team mean?
It's giving yourself for the whole. Very simple. Runner at first base, runner at third, hit and run, hit the ball on the ground, score the run from third, send the guy to second base, you're out. You get no credit for it in the statistics, but you just scored a run and you advance another guy to second base. That's one example, being able to bunt, being able to hit and run, being able to do the little things that win, always being alert, backing up the other guy at all times. Every time there's a ball thrown to third, you run if you're the second base, run over in case it gets by the first baseman, in case it gets. Those are all team efforts. And you can't stand and look at things. You got to keep moving all the time, and you got to be ready and wary. And the thought process in baseball is almost as important as the physical part. You got to know what to do, when to do, and how to do it. You got to know who the runners are, who the base stealers are, who the hitters are, where they're going to hit. And anytime there's a situation, you back somebody up and help them out if you can.
In your amazing life, you've met so many fascinating people. Who's the one that you admire the most?
My mother.
Why?
Well, what she went through, you know, we went through the Depression with nothing, and she raised two kids, my sister and I, and we lived in very, very impoverished places. And she kept things going, kept us going to church, kept us alert, kept us going. And for me, my education came at the dinner table. With my sister was a straight-A student. I didn't like student studies much, rather, and my sister was a straight-A student. So I got a lot of my educational process at the dinner table through her guidance, and she was just a magnificent human being.
Of all your achievements, what are you proudest of?
Surviving, period. I don't know what to say. I don't consider, you know, when you're out there doing it, you just do them. I don't consider, you know, doing this, that, or the other thing is an achievement. I consider doing and being a part of the good things that are going on. That's the best part of life.
How long are you going to keep announcing?
Well, my contract extends two more years through 2009. After that, they may shoot me. I don't know. It's hard to say. But as long as my health holds, and I've been very fortunate, I've been luckily, I've never had any problems, serious illnesses, whatever. But you never know. One day you get a pain here, and suddenly it could be cancer. You get a problem there, it could be something else. You just don't know. But basically, just staying healthy, and I'm happy to keep doing what I'm doing.
Jerry Coleman, you're a great American, a modern-day hero, a great inspiration. Thanks for doing this today.
Jack, nice to talk to you, and hope you go well, too.
God bless.
All right.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.